The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, the Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damian Thompson. James Orr was living the life of a young, high-flying lawyer when, after a few drinks at a New Year's Eve party, he asked for signs that God existed. The signs came. Among other things, he narrowly avoided a fatal skiing accident. Now he is a passionate Christian and a conservative culture warrior who helped defeat an attempt to impose the tyranny of critical race theory on Cambridge University, where he's an associate professor of the philosophy of religion. He's also an intellectual mentor to the Vice President of the United States. Politico describes him as J.D. Vance's English philosopher king. Dr. Orr says Vance is extremely articulate, but he takes no prisoners. As you'll hear in this episode of Holy Smoke, that's an observation that could easily apply to the man the Vice President calls his British Sherpa. James, it's great to have you on the podcast. Your thought is so rich and complex that I wonder if we could start with something relatively straightforward, which is your conversion story. And I've been reading Justin Brearley's website. And here's this wonderful description. Having graduated and embarked on a promising career in law, James was nevertheless asking himself existential questions. On New Year's Eve 2002, he prayed a skeptical and, he admits, fairly drunken prayer, asking God if he was there to reveal himself. Remarkably, from the very next morning and over the following 2 months, James said he experienced a number of very specific and unusual answers to his prayers. I'd like to ask you about that, not least because I used to drink a lot and stopped completely, and that was a very important part of my life story. I'm not saying you were anything like I was, but tell me what happened. You were already well-versed in the classics. You'd already left Oxford. Were you working for Freshfields? You were working for one of the smart law firms. So tell me why, having had a few glasses on New Year's Eve, you prayed this prayer, and tell me how it was answered.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's great to be with you, Damien. Looking back on that time, it was just more than 20 years ago. I sometimes think that, you know, providence works in ways we least expect. And I grew up as a pretty bookish teenager. I was fortunate enough to go to Winchester, which is a great academic hothouse. And that opened up all kinds of intellectual vistas, in particular in the classics. I loved Latin, loved Greek, loved Homer and Plato and Virgil and Ovid and so on. I carried on doing that at Oxford. But I think what that meant was that books were leading me away from the divine rather than towards it. And so the experience that I had was not remotely intellectual. It was existential and experiential. And so it was a boozy evening on New Year's Eve 2002. And I suppose having just left university, still finding my feet in London, this is probably not an uncommon experience of sort of, you know, young people emerging into the sort of the big smoke, having been used to being top of their various institutions up until that point, realizing that they've got a very, very long, hard grind ahead of them. And so I suppose that it's natural to ask existential questions about what's life all about, where am I heading, what is the meaning of all of this? And so I suppose those are the thoughts going through my slightly addled brain. And I thought to myself, well, look, if God is real, then he can disclose himself to me, he can reveal himself to me in some way. So that was the context of uttering my skeptical prayer very late at night on New Year's Eve 2002. And really over the course of the next 24 hours, 48 hours, actually all the way up through, I think, to around about mid-February, these prayers were answered in quite specific and unusual ways. And although I decided that it was the rational thing to do with each of these apparent answers was to dismiss them. The cumulative weight of them over the course of 4, 5, 6 weeks made me realize that it was actually becoming increasingly irrational to simply dismiss the pattern. And so that's what led me eventually to darken the door of a church. I tried out all sorts of different churches.
What were the pattern though? What were the things that were happening?
Well, let me give you an example. So that I remember sort of drifting off to sleep New Year's Eve 2002. And I remember it was a sort of fairly blurred image, but it was my hand reaching up out of a pit and clasping a larger hand and being sort of yanked up. And I didn't really know where that image came from, but it just popped into my head. And then I sort of fell asleep. And I remember waking up the following morning and reaching for my mobile phone and, you know, sending a few New Year's Eve texts to friends back in England. I was in Switzerland at the time. And I don't know if you remember those old clunky Nokia phones. When you turn them on, they had that moment at the beginning on the green screen of a small hand being clasping a larger hand. And it was exactly the image in that sort of rather, you know, green digitized form. It's exactly the image that had passed through my addled brain just a few hours before when I drifted off to sleep. And I thought, gosh, that's a little bit weird. But I thought, you're going to have to do better than that. I'm not going to take that as some sort of celestial sign. So I put it out of my mind, went off skiing a couple of hours later, and we were on a very, very difficult run. It was terrible weather, and we were going down a very nasty gully across black ice, and I just decided to just bomb across it, go all the way down, skiing with my sister down this slope. And at some point, I just thought, we're going too fast, which is saying something, you know, for me. I'd love to just bomb down the slopes and don't take any concern at all for my safety or my sister's. But at that point, I screamed at her, said, we've got to stop. And we screeched to a halt. And the mist cleared. And it became apparent that we were on the top of a flat roofed chalet, with 2 meters ahead, an 8-foot drop onto jagged rocks beyond us. And she looked at me and said, gosh, how did you know how to stop just like that? I said, I have no idea. I was just seized with this frenzy that we had to stop. Anyway, we moved around to the edge of this chalet. We climbed all the way down and just collapsed in the snow. And I looked around, and there was this 8-foot high wooden crucifix, enormous wooden crucifix, propping up the chalet. And I turned to my sister and I said, what on earth is that doing there? I mean, what is it? Why would there be a crucifix propping up a chalet? And she looked at me completely baffled and puzzled and said, I've got no idea. It's just, you know, it is what it is. Switzerland's an odd place. And so again, I thought, gosh, well, you know, what do I make of that? And I dismissed it again, just as I had with the funny Nokia image. And anyway, these little patterns just kept happening. And I said, not good enough, God, not good enough, not good enough. But the signs kept emerging. I came back to London. The same sorts of things happened again. And I think by mid-February, I thought, right, okay, there's something's going on here. I've at least got to respond in some way. And so I started trying out different churches in London. And I think probably a breakthrough was trying the church that I was least comfortable in. And that was the charismatic evangelical branch of the Church of England. So I ended up at Holy Trinity Brompton. If you told me at Oxford that I would spend more than a minute in a church like that, I'd have thought you were completely mad. But I think because it forced me so dramatically out of my comfort zone, it was so, so different from what I'd been used to, the chapel, the high church style that I loved at Winchester and Oxford. It sort of jolted me out of the sort of conventional way of thinking about Christianity. And apart from anything else, the people at Holy Trinity Brompton are just absolutely lovely people.
But let me stop you there for a second. You say it's the church you felt least comfortable in, and perhaps from a liturgical point of view, that was true. But I've been to many services at HTB, and I know he's not vicar anymore, but I'm a great fan of Nicky Gumbel. But I started writing about him in the days when Sandy Miller was the vicar. Both of them, actually old Etonian lawyers who became men of the cloth, absolutely full of blonde-haired public schoolboys who'd been to Oxford and Cambridge and went skiing. So at some level, you can't have felt that uncomfortable, James.
I think from a social point of view, you're probably right. I mean, on the few occasions that friends tried to convert me at Oxford, I ended up going to the more Calvinist wing, occasionally went to the sort of Calvinist wing of the Church of England, sort of conservative evangelical wing, and I didn't...
HTB was actually quite Calvinist under Sandy Miller.
Yes, so it wasn't when I was there. It was very much Wesleyan, charismatic, and it certainly tended to downplay all the sort of hot-button issues. The sort of seeker-sensitive model, the vineyard model of charismatic Christianity was, by that point at least, in 2003, 2004, 2005, very different, really, from St. Helens Bishopsgate and All Souls Langham Place and St. Ebbs in Oxford. But no, I take your point. I felt a sense of kind of social ease in a church like that. But I also saw a remarkable diversity there. I mean, one of the very important experiences I had early on in that church was on an Alpha course, one of these weekends away. And during the session, Nikki Gumbel read out a letter from a very moving letter from a woman who had been a prostitute, a heroin addict, all her hair had fallen out, she'd been abused by her pimp, and she'd ended up in the graveyard of Holy Trinity, Brompton. And a family in the church took her in, and her life was transformed, and she came to faith. And I was listening to this letter, and I thought, my goodness me, this sounds almost unbelievable. But anyway, I didn't think much more of it. And we went off into these little small groups that they do on the Alpha course. And I was sitting in this rather dingy little room in a sort of Pontins-type hotel down in Chichester. And there was a chap who was clearly a sort of Chelsea fan, you know, drinking his beers at 11 a.m. And in walked the most gorgeous woman I'd ever seen. She was blonde, black leather trousers, black polo neck, a sort of lovely gold necklace, and she plopped herself down next to me, and I thought, oh, she's just absolutely wonderful. I just started talking to her. Anyway, the group discussion began, and the leader, there was a sort of awkward silence, and then the Chelsea chap sort of burped and said, staring at this girl to my right, saying, I just want to say, Angie, it was really brave of you to let Nikki read out that letter of yours. And I suddenly realized that with sort of shock that this woman to my right, barely 18 months before, had been a wraith, abused, just lying in a churchyard, basically abandoned. And I talked to her over the course of that morning and over the afternoon and heard more of her story in detail. And I thought, my goodness, this person is not your standard Knightsbridge type. And yet she'd been welcomed in and her life had been transformed and turned around and she'd become this extraordinary, you know, pillar of the church. And I thought, my gosh, there is something at work here. I don't fully understand it, but it's extraordinary. And this is a church that is, yes, dominated by Hooray Henrys like me, but also remarkably open to all, and in particular to the marginalized and those who feel that they don't really belong anywhere else.
Did you feel at any point that you were missing out on the great ancient liturgical traditions of Christianity, most of which are pretty well banished from your typical HTB service?
I had had so much of that at boarding school. And I had been enriched by it at boarding school. So I wasn't one of those public school boys who just sort of, you know, became allergic to liturgy and chapel. I actually rather loved it. I mean, I was pretty much an agnostic all the way through school and Oxford. But I did enjoy that side of things. I liked, I liked the King James Bible and all the sort of the intonations I liked the sort of very high Anglican sermons. I was in the choir at school and loved all of that. So I think there was enough of that in me, as it were. And I didn't miss it too much at the time. And then within 4 or 5 years, I came up to Cambridge. And of course, Cambridge, well, there's absolutely everything you could possibly want. But Cambridge does the sort of liturgical high liturgy of Anglicanism almost better than anywhere else in the world.
Oxford would dispute that. Oxford regards Cambridge as Cromwellian.
Well, there's maybe some truth to that. I was at Balliol, where there was not much of a chapel tradition.
No.
And not much of a choral tradition either. And there was always that sort of secular, skeptical atmosphere in the college, and certainly since the 60s, after it took a very sharp turn left. So, but I was at John's as a PhD student for 5 years, and the choral tradition there was just absolutely wonderful. And being part of the Advent services, which are always on Radio 3 in the beginning of December, and actually I even got to do a lesson or two. So I feel I've more than had my fill. But I think in terms of that sort of the communal dimension of Christianity and the taste of what it would have been like to be in those sort of early Christian groups, I think HTB actually captures very, very well than the sort of its home groups and its pastorates and so on. So I felt welcomed, and it was a church in which one felt that Christianity was just normal. It was just something that one could practice, and you didn't have to be an odd bod. This was very, very successful people were Christians and enjoying it and living the Christian life, and some very, very humble people too. And that was something that really powered me on in the faith. And I noticed coming up to Cambridge, whenever it was, 15, 16 years ago, it's very fashionable among Oxbridge Anglicans, particularly in the colleges, to be very dismissive of the evangelical tradition, particularly dismissive of the sort of charismatic tradition at HDB. And I've always resisted that, and always felt a great debt of gratitude to that tradition and to the great leaders of that church in that period, Sandy Miller and Nicky Gumbel, and the many, many others who
and
they
that tradition
raised
has changed,
up.
I think. I mean, I remember when HDB took over St. Augustine's in South Kensington. Is it St. Augustine's, Queen's Gate? And that was an Anglo-Catholic church. And I said to Nicky, well, what do you do when you conduct services there? You're expected to wear a chasuble on his incest and things. He said, yes, I don't have a problem with that at all. And I thought, gosh, your predecessors would have had a very big problem with that. But it's interesting how evangelicalism has, as they used to say in the C of E, moved up the candle so that, for example, it's nothing surprising about an HDB graduate, as it were, Justin Welby, frequently used to celebrate the Eucharist wearing a chasuble, which is something you almost never saw, for example, George Carey doing. I did see him doing it once. He looked very uncomfortable indeed. So, if you like, the sort of churchmanship of the Church of England seems to have become much less demarcated than it was. Would you agree?
I think that's probably right. I mean, I defer to your expertise on that, but one thing I noticed about HTB, and certainly Nicky's vision for the re-evangelization of the nation and the revivification of the Church of England, is that it is not, contrary to what some think, a kind of imperialistic project. So that it is not the sort of self-understanding of HTB's mission to impose charismatic forms of worship wherever it, all over the country. It wants to work and support the traditions that are alive and that are working, and it recognizes the and respects the range of styles of Christian worship. Yes, if it's taking over a church and planting a church down in Brighton or Hastings or wherever it might be, and it's just an empty husk of a building, then yes, it will effectively sort of set up what it knows, the formula that it knows works, which is its charismatic tradition, broadly speaking, and Alpha as well. But I think Alpha, because it's the success of Alpha so transcends the different styles. I mean, for example, it's going gangbusters in the Catholic Church. It's doing very, very well in America. It's doing well in Latin America. I've been out to Malaysia and seen what the work that Alpha are doing in changing, designing the course and adapting it for the Southeast Asian context.
Oh, yes, my local Catholic parish has had Alpha. My late mother did it in her 80s.
Yeah, and so the fact that it is this global phenomenon and was from the very beginning has meant that HTB was never able, it was never really able to sort of impose its particular form of sort of vineyard English charismatic style on absolutely, all the different churches that Alpha was reaching all around the world.
Just a little caveat. When I first wrote about HTB, which would have been when you were, while you were still at Winchester, probably, when I first wrote about it in the Daily Telegraph, it was accused of behaving a bit like a cult. And I did indeed speak to a woman who said she'd been very damaged by her encounter with HTB. This was before Nikki was vicar. And she, you know, she was very forthright, and yes, was, I think, very damaged by what she saw as an attempt to control her personal life and to manipulate emotions through some of the meetings. And my great friend, who died last year at the age of 90, Donald Reeves, who was the extremely liberal vicar or rector of St. James's Piccadilly, fought a long campaign back in those days against HTB, which he thought was a tremendously dangerous. And I remember, and I'm really not having a go at HTB, and perhaps I'm having a go at HTB in the past, but I remember talking to Robert Runcie once, lovely man, and he said he thought that HTB represented a serious threat to the future and integrity of the Church of England. He just said that to my face. But it was a different era at a time when HTB was associated with taking over churches and changing their and driving out the traditional worshippers and importing these prayer groups and this informal way of worship that was coupled with a not very informal, you know, interest in the private lives of the faithful.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, that's a criticism that one could level against any form of Christianity that takes that more Wesleyan experiential mode.
Also against Catholic groups as well.
Right. And, you know, of course there are dangers there, just as there are dangers in the much more sort of repressed, stiff upper lip form kinds of Christianity where there's a sort of zero emotion. And so it's impossible for any one church to get it right. What I would say is that although the mid-90s, though I wasn't there, this was long before I arrived, though the mid-90s were a sort of a pretty tempestuous, chaotic time for the charismatic movement in England, as the Toronto Blessing in particular was beginning to bed down in 1994, it must have been, I'm sure there was an awful lot of fallout from it. And yet, I remember Nikki mentioning a wise letter from Leslie Newbegin to the Times around about that period, 94, 95, effectively saying, look, we don't fully understand what's going on, but we should be patient, and by their fruits shall ye know them, and just wait and see what comes of this. And I don't think it's a coincidence that 1994 was the year in which the first Alpha International Conference was launched, and all of the associated ministries that flowed out of that to do with marriage, to do with parenting, post-abortion counselling, and so on and so forth, the whole panoply of ministries that, and including Alpha, that grew out of that very odd time, emerging from in the wake of the transposition of the Toronto Blessing to HDB, where which you know triggered an awful lot of reputational damage to the church. But I think most of the people in the leadership at the time and those in the congregation at the time at HTB in the mid-90s recognized that that was the moment when, as it were, all sorts of seeds were sown that bore enormous fruit for the wider church. And so I think Runcie, bless him, and he was a very good friend of my father-in-law, who was also a bishop at the time, was wrong on that. And I think if there had not been that, if it hadn't been for the catalytic impact of HDB and its associated ministries, the Church of England would be in a far, far direr place than it is even now.
I think I agree with you. I remember interviewing Nikki. This was years after I'd written my hit piece, I suppose it was in some respects, big feature in The Telegraph. And I remember interviewing Nikki. I forget whether it's for The Telegraph or maybe for The Spectator. Coming away profoundly impressed by what he had to say and profoundly impressed by the distance he had moved on a number of topics. I remember a rather startling thing he said to me. I said, well, what about homosexuality? And he said, well, I just remember that Jesus never mentioned the topic, which wasn't what I was expecting him to say. I remember at one point, a priest, I won't say which priest, but a priest from the oratory next door with whom he had very good relations. I once met him at an oratory thing, and Nikki was dressed up in full black Anglo-Catholic clerical. and I said, Father, how nice to see you. But anyway, I remember a priest at HTB saying to Nikki, you're hanging around with too many liberal Catholics. Stick to your Protestantism. It's much sounder. But when Justin Welby, whom I imagine you ran into in your HTB days.
I did.
Yeah, well, when Justin Welby was made Archbishop of Canterbury, in some respects, I hoped he'd bring more of HGB to the Church of England than he actually did.
Yep.
Because the clarity of message I was expecting just evaporated. And there was this awful, I'm one of those people who don't apologize for using the word woke everybody else feels they need to. But this awful woke drivel came out of his lips. Maybe I'm wearing a chasuble, but that didn't make up for the fact that he was talking, you know, trendy nonsense week after week after week. Do you understand my frustration?
Well, I certainly can. And, you know, Justin Welby, my father-in-law ordained him, actually, and in Coventry. And
could I ask you, who was your father-in-law?
Simon Barrington Ward, who was Bishop of Coventry from...
Oh, yes, I remember him, yes.
85, 86 to 97. And he knew Justin. I think he actually arranged Justin's gap year travels to Africa, where he did some ministry work, and then kept in touch with him over the years and advised him through ordination, and was he was one of my father-in-law's curates. And so I'd always sort of been aware of him from, you know, quite early on, and I think we met once or twice when he was Dean of Liverpool. And yes, I remember we were doing cartwheels when he was appointed. I thought this is great. You know, he hasn't got the intellectual firepower of a Rowan Williams, but he's got that sort of evangelical clarity that but without the sort of hard edge, perhaps, of a George Carey, and that this is just what the church needs for another, you know, just to sort of steady the ship for the next 10 years. And then I think quite quickly I realized I could see the wheels coming off, and indeed I could see quite obvious signs of divergence from what I knew to be the position of HDB, the HDB leadership and the movement as a whole. I think one of the structural problems, and I remember having a conversation either with him or one of his assistants about it, was choosing to put reconciliation as a ministry in front and center. Now, coming out of Coventry and the Coventry's great relationship with Dresden, and my father-in-law did an awful lot of work on this, reconciliation was this, you know, it was a buzzword. It was a very, very important way of thinking, filtering Christian moral theology. And yet I realized that would be a problem if he was going to take it into into Canterbury, into Lambeth Palace, because the one thing you don't want to do when you're at the top of an organization is to be a reconciler. To be a reconciler is to be a fence sitter. And what I realized was that if he was going to steady the ship, he was going to have to take some risks, and he was going to need to show some bold leadership. He was going to need to antagonize at one side, I think, you know, the more liberal wing. But I think he was so obsessed with the idea of himself as somebody who would not take sides, but would try to sort of join basically irreconcilable wings of the Church of England, paralyzed him. And so the whole sort of conceptual framing of his ministry meant that really from the beginning, he was never going to be able to show that sort of bold leadership that the church so desperately needed at the time.
Do you think there's a parallel with Pope Francis, who, as we speak, is fighting for his life? And, you know, I will speak of him with perhaps more respect than I usually do. It's horrible to see him going through this ordeal. But when he became Pope, I remember a priest friend of mine who'd been very keen on Benedict saying, well, the new Pope is low church, but that doesn't matter because he's going to preach the gospel. And then almost immediately, there was a focus on social issues and politically fashionable issues, and all done in the rather dictatorial managerial fashion that Welby has also been accused of. Now, I don't think they're too particularly close, but nonetheless, do you see some parallels?
I do. I mean, I think the most immediate parallel is that both Welby and Francis were successors to some of the finest minds in the history of their respective churches. It's a very, very difficult thing to follow an intellectual giant of the caliber of Rowan Williams, and it's even harder for a Pope Francis to follow not one but two intellectual giants in John Paul II and Benedict XVI. So in a way, there was an enormous sort of burden on them, and they had to differentiate themselves by appealing to a more pastoral, less intellectually heavyweight mode of ministry.
Which is okay. That's fine.
Which is absolutely fine. And there was something, you know, I remember the early days of Pope Francis, there was something rather wonderful about his, you know, simplicity, his humility, his, you know, avoiding the papal apartments, sort of simpler vestments, that sort of quite direct, spontaneous communication style. And And similarly with Welby, there was a sort of, you know, tough, you know, hard-nosed pragmatism, a sort of, you know, quite a steely business-like approach, which was, you know, we've, I think, felt was going to be, you know, appropriate for the times. But yes, I think both of them have struggled to maintain any kind of unity across the sort of the deep divisions. You know, both of them have seen waning attendance in their respective churches. Well, certainly there's a case in Europe, out of thought, but also in the Church of England as well. And both of them have lurched towards a much more liberal and progressive posture on the hot button issues at exactly the time when they really ought to have held the line on homosexuality, of course, and same-sex marriage, divorce in the case of Pope Francis, and also a deafening silence on, in the case of Welby, a deafening silence on some really egregious erosions of freedom of religion, freedom of conscience.
Oh, deafening silence from the Vatican too, let me assure you. Deafening,
yes.
Particularly in the case of China. Continues to this day, will continue, you know, if God forbid Cardinal Parolin becomes the next pope, it will continue. Just have to ask you one question, my little obsession. There is a revival in the Catholic Church. It's small and modest, but it is centered on the celebration of the traditional ancient Latin Mass. But, you know, Pope Francis tried to suppress. Any thoughts on that? Because many of my Anglican friends are as outspoken on it as are my Catholic ones. I mean, Marcus Walker, for example, is horrified.
Yes, I mean, speaking as an outsider, I'm not aware of all the sort of ins and outs, but I have some very dear friends for whom the traditional Latin Mass means a very great deal, and I see that in them. And I don't understand why Pope Francis has been pushing so aggressively against it. It seems to me wildly disproportionate. It seems to me, even if he was not on board with it, it's quite clear that it's at the heart of what revival there is within the church, within the Catholic Church. And it would seem to be, you know, a church leader who can see signs of growth should not be stamping out the engines of that growth. And so, no, it grieves me to learn of it. And I just hope that the next pope, his successor, will have a more sort of benign and attitude towards it. But of course, these things once they're set in stone are very difficult to reverse.
Oh, this one isn't at all difficult to reverse. It's very easy to reverse. It can be done with a stroke of the pen, just so long as that wretched Parolin doesn't get the job.
Well, let's hope it does happen. But yes,
I wanted to ask you about your theological thinking, your philosophical thinking. Out of my depth again here, possibly even more so than I was with Alistair McGrath, but you are Associate Professor of Philosophy of Religion at the Faculty of Divinity of Cambridge. And I read from your official biography there that you're interested in the philosophical traffic between continental phenomenology and the recovery of pre-modern metaphysical prisms, especially monotheistic ones, to account for laws, powers, causation, kinds, function, and conscious awareness itself. Now, I wonder if I could just stick that into Google Translate for a second. I think I know what you're on about, but it's not my area. So could I ask you for an outline of it?
Well, look, to put it as simply as I can, I suppose, and that's really a job description for the guild rather than for the general public. But within philosophy, you've got this secular philosophy. You've got a big split between the so-called continental tradition and the analytic Anglophone tradition. And typically, philosophers have to pick a tribe. You have to choose a side. One of the great things about working in philosophical theology and philosophy of religion is that you recognize that you understand and indeed inhabit the hinterlands of these great traditions. You know, unlike a lot of my Cambridge philosophy colleagues, you know, you don't think that philosophy just began pretty much in 1903 with Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore and Ludwig Wittgenstein. You recognize that things go far, far, you know, the history of Western philosophy goes way, 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 way back. And that figures like Plato and Aristotle and Augustine and Aquinas are rich thinkers and indeed were got a lot right. Or even if they didn't get a lot right, they had very, very powerful and plausible ways of thinking about how reality fits together. And a lot of the ways in which modern philosophy has tended to approach the fundamental questions of, for example, non-accidental regularities in the natural world, like what we call laws of nature, or functions in biological organisms, or essences and properties and substances, objects, all these sort of interesting metaphysical questions, has tended to be very, very reductive. And it's been very, very positivistic. The idea is that everything is to be understood through the very narrow, etiolated prism of the science of the natural sciences. And what's wonderful about figures like Aquinas and Augustine and Plato and Aristotle is that they're very happy with a much richer way of thinking about reality that understands that not all reality is scientific reality, that there are many, many dimensions of the world and of human experience that resist scientific reduction, whether it be morality, whether it be the reality of our mental lives and the irreducibility of our subjective experience, whether it be the infinitely large domain of mathematics, questions to do with possibility and modality, or questions to do with metaphysics itself, or meaning, the meaning of life. These are just not scientific questions. It's not a failure of science that it doesn't address these questions. It's simply to recognize that science has its proper limits. So that's the great, that's what I love about my work. It allows me, theology and faith gives me permission to do philosophy in a much richer and more substantive way than my secular philosophical colleagues, who I think are operating in a much, much more restrained and sort of reductive scientistic framework.
Well, you mentioned the gulf between English and continental philosophy and the tribal battles associated with it. Do you think that in some sort of miserable, simplified way, those conflicts have been reflected in more recent academic conflicts, especially at Cambridge University, in which you've been a protagonist and very much on the right side, between champions of freedom of thought, of which you're one, and those who sought to impose critical race theory on the University of Cambridge? And indeed, you said, a casual visitor to a campaign called Change the Culture, which eventually failed, could have been forgiven for thinking that the Fens had been overrun by marauding mobs of racists, homophobes, and misogynists. You called it a brazen attempt by the university's senior leadership to wire the coddling vision into the ancient fabric of Cambridge. And when this Change the Culture campaign had to be abandoned, you wrote some lovely things. And I'll just quote one of them, which is, the university has been spared the sight of dons tiptoeing backwards out of lecture theatres, eyebrows carefully furrowed, anxiously avoiding giving any compliments and busily consulting the latest encyclopedia of approved pronouns. Factor in genuflections with raised fists for Black Lives Matter and the physiological toll that woke calisthenics would have taken on portly professors doesn't bear thinking about. That's hilarious, beautifully put. But actually what you're talking about is a very sinister reality, and not one, I think, that's been banished simply by the failure of one campaign.
It was a very strange time that I remember it very clearly, that the summer of 2020 and then 2021. I remember when the email came through to all the staff here at Cambridge setting out this Change the Culture project, and the shopping list of so-called microaggressions that effectively massively expanded the scope of professional misconduct for both staff and students. And I remember turning to my wife and saying, I think I've got to resign. This is going to paralyze the intellectual culture of the university, not just the intellectual culture, but all forms of interaction are going to be potentially reportable on an anonymous basis to the university authorities, and this is going to weaponize and strengthen HR to the point where we're going to cease to be a university. But she talked me down. And I remember heading off into my heart in the garden, sitting down and thinking through a lot of the issues, and talked about them with a couple of friends. And we got a memo together, which we circulated. And we realized pretty early on that what the university was proposing flatly contravene the Equality Act 2010. Somewhat to my surprise, I found myself appealing to the equality legislation to point out that not even the British government at the time was willing to define racism solely as a phenomenon perpetrated by white people against non-white people, which the university had defined racism as. And so it was a very, very strange time. However, thanks to the increasing extramural support for the universities and for free speech more generally, we were able to effectively defeat the campaign. And the vice chancellor at the time, a Canadian human rights lawyer called Stephen Toop, stepped down, I think, just a few months later and resigned. Now, I think it was almost certainly to do with that those incidents. And since then, I must say, you know, things are not perfect, but my sense, certainly when talking to colleagues at Harvard and Stanford and Princeton, that things in Cambridge and Oxford are far, far better on that front, on the sort of academic freedom, freedom of association, freedom of speech front, than is the case at the Ivy Leagues, which really are...
That's not saying very much, though, is it?
That's true. It's a low bar. But I think Oxford and Cambridge, I think particularly the medieval topography of Oxford and Cambridge, the relative sort of dispersal of power in the medieval university across the colleges, has meant that it's got more antidotes to woke ideological capture than a more top-down, dirigiste, campus-based model in the United States, where you've effectively got, you know, if you've got one woke president in Claudine Gay, can do irreparable damage downstream to the whole of the university. That's not the case so much in Oxford and Cambridge. The vice chancellors have some power, but much, much less than their US equivalents. And colleges still, although it's waning a little, still have that quasi-autonomous executive power wielded by the trustees, that is to say, the fellowship. And although there are very, certainly I don't think there's a single college in Oxford or Cambridge that has anything approaching a conservative majority, there are a handful of colleges where things are relatively balanced, at least where the groupthink has not fully taken over. And so the challenge is to just ensure that there is as intellectually and ideologically diverse an intellectual culture as possible. Not easily achieved.
Well, it works both ways. I mean, you know, there's a degree of freedom, but also it means that an individual college can go completely woke. My old college is Mansfield, which in my day was a very poor and obscure institution, and is now, I don't know if it's rolling in money, it's got a lot more money than it used to have, and it's got a lot more influence than it used to have, and that's by going completely woke. Becoming a sort of, you know, almost like a Peter Simple caricature of a woke college. I'll never be invited back after saying that. There's many nice things about it. But it can't have been easy being a conservative academic at Cambridge, given the general intellectual climate. And I don't just mean of your colleagues, because, you know, that would have been true for decades, but of students as well. Because even I was talking to a friend of mine whose grandson is at Oxford at the moment, and she said, well, he's terribly left-wing, as the vast majority of them are. Did you find that? You must have felt very much in a minority with your conservative allegiance, which is quite open.
I'm very fortunate in having some of the very best young people passing through my lecture halls, and I've always avoided introducing politics into my teaching. I just lecture on Plato and Aristotle, Kant, Hume, Kierkegaard, Iris Murdoch. And actually, you know, politics doesn't really come into it. And I don't see it as my role to impose my political outlook on my students. And there's nothing in the curricular content of the papers that I've designed that that pushes one particular view.
But merely not introducing a political is in itself a statement, isn't it?
That is true. That, I mean, in many ways, yes, I won't sort of, I'm not interested in talking about feminism or decolonization or empire or any of those kinds, or race. That, you know, you will just, if that's what you're after, you're not going to find any of that in my lectures. You might find the odd cursory dismissal. And so I suppose that, yes, neutrality now is to be politically neutral is to take a side these days. But in my experience, students are very receptive and they tend to be quite balanced. And I haven't really had many problems at all. I mean, there is, of course, fairly regular hit pieces about me, about some sort of hurty words I might have said on Twitter about something, and the student newspapers will get into a tizzy about
it. I've had to take myself off Twitter more or less. I get somebody else to speak for me because I was saying hurty words come very naturally to me. But then, your students will have read an article in Politico whose headline was "Meet J.D. Vance's English Philosopher King." You've been friends for years, haven't you? And you are an influence on the vice president, of whom I'm a great admirer. Not sure I agree with him about everything. In fact, I certainly don't. But I find him an enormously impressive figure. And in one interview, you said, "I think there is a sort of link between the sort of tech bro side of J.D. and the trad bro side. That sort of intellectual fertility and civilizational confidence that cultural fertility is actually tied up with. Demographers think that there's an empirical connection, and notice that highly religious communities that are confident about the future will tend to have more babies." Okay, let's just park that last bit for a second, because it's very interesting. Could you just tell us a little bit about JD? He comes across as polished and warm-hearted and intellectually ferocious at the same time, certainly the most impressive vice president I can remember of either party for a very long time. Maybe some people would say Al Gore was a formidable figure. I was never a fan. What's he like?
He is one of the most down-to-earth people I've ever met. And, I first got to know him when he was just a private citizen, a well-known private citizen. He was still sort of basking in the glow of the reception, the very extremely positive reception to his Hillbilly Elegy book in 2016. And in many ways, he was a sort of Trump or Trumpism whisperer for the coastal elites in that book. And in that period, he was held aloft as, a great hero of the elites, as somebody who'd sort of emerged from...
Well, he said some very rude things about Trump, didn't he?
At the time, he did. Yes, not publicly. Those were private conversations that were then sort of parlayed into a campaign to undermine his bid to be Senator of Ohio in 2022. But no, so our conversations, I got to know him, I think, very shortly after he was received into the Catholic Church. And at the time, it is still the case, in fact, that there were all sorts of problems going on in the Church of England that I was worrying about. And we talked, most of our early conversations were really just about religion and God and faith and Catholicism and Augustine, very interested in Augustine, and talked a lot about post-liberalism. We were big fans of the work of our mutual friend, Patrick Deneen. And so, we stayed in touch, and he came over to England, a couple of years ago, I think, and came to stay with us here in Cambridge with Usha and his three kids and his in-laws, and had a very, he was having a holiday in England and just spending some time in Cambridge. He's a big fan Usha had spent some time. She did a master's here. In fact, we overlapped. Usha was at Clare and in the early 2010s doing, I think, a master's in law. And yes, I remember those conversations. He wanted to talk about, he wanted to meet Robert Toombs, the author of The English and Their History. So he clearly read The English and Their History, which is this big doorstopper of a book, one of probably the finest history of the English ever written. And he was, conversant with it and takes his roots in Britain very, very seriously. And I think, as you could tell from that Munich speech a couple of weeks ago, is deeply concerned at the erosions of basic liberties and the basic liberties that in many ways he and his fellow Americans see Britain as having been the cradle of.
I'm deeply concerned by those things too. I was applauding the vice president when he said those things. You mentioned Patrick Deneen. He blocks me on Twitter because I've been extremely critical of the integralist movement. That is an attempt to a vision of a reconstructed Christian civilization which would deprive, in some expositions of it, deprive people of basic civil liberties, and which I think anyway is a sort of medieval cosplay. Certainly, I think the things said by people like Adrian Van Mule are absolutely preposterous. You mentioned in this quote demographics. Well, I mean, how are you going to fix demographics so that people actually vote these proposals? To what extent do you think J.D. Vance is influenced by one or other versions of integralism?
Not at all.
Good. Very pleased to
hear. Not at all. He is not an integralist, and nor is he, I think, remotely tempted by integralism. And actually, to be fair to Patrick, though he is associated in many ways with Adrian Vermeule, he's not a full-bore integralist. And I think the value of Patrick's work for me and the vice president, and I know for many others, is really his analysis of the twilight of liberalism and what was driving the unraveling of liberalism. And I think we are very much in the conservative camp that would differ from, say, a Roger Scruton, who says that really conservatism is a hesitation within liberalism, that conservatism is downstream of the kind of the liberal moment, the emergence of liberalism ex nihilo in the Enlightenment, and actually sees the only conservatism worth having as being something that is pre-liberal, that understands that the only freedom worth having is ordered freedom, freedom that is downstream of ultimately unchosen obligations involving faith and family, nationhood, belonging, community, and so on and so forth. And so I think that what we appreciate in Deneen's work is the understanding that progressivism, wokeism, and all the excesses we've seen in the Cultural Revolution of the recent years is actually a feature of liberalism and not some bug, that this was actually how liberalism was always going to end. Yes, catalyzed by technological revolutions, and in particular the digital revolution, but nevertheless accelerating what was always going to be the outcome of an ideology that prized freedom and the self-legislating subject above all else.
Well, there's the liberalism of the academy, which can be almost fascist in its insistence on ideological rigor and its attempt to suppress free speech. But then there's the sort of drift towards social liberalism, which you find among, you know, Republicans, among Trump supporters, as well as Democrats. I mean, you know, if you look at opinion polls in America, the GOP is only about 5 years behind the social attitudes of the Democrats. And you know, if you look at attitudes towards homosexuality, for example, there's no indication of a turning back towards a more conservative position in the general population. Now, you talk about demographers thinking that there's an empirical connection, and notice that highly religious communities that are confident about the future will tend to have more babies. And you're absolutely right about that, which is one of the reasons it's so myopic of the current Vatican to try and crush a traditionalist Catholic movement in which people are having children to whom they will pass on the faith. Whether they will be successful or not in the modern world is difficult to say, but it's a necessary but not sufficient condition, isn't it?
Yes.
So how confident are you that demographics might carry Christianity back to higher ground?
It's an immensely difficult question. And I actually, on the same-sex marriage question, I saw some data earlier, I think it was today or even yesterday, that suggests that approval of same-sex marriage in the United States has hit rock bottom. So it's not as if a lot of these kind of social conservative flashpoints don't, you know, that liberalism is always operates on a ratchet. I mean, the reversal of Roe v. Wade and Dobson Jackson, although it's actually led to an increase in the overall number of abortions in the United States, does suggest that you know, the liberal ratchet is not, it doesn't work sort of relentlessly and kind of inexorably in one direction. On demographics, I mean, Eric Kaufman wrote that wonderful book about 15 years ago now, Shall the Religious Inherit the Earth? And his thesis is that yes, you know, fertility is quite tightly correlated to, and this is important, orthodox, conservative, ultra-trad religious commitment, not just religious commitment more generally. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. On the other hand, there are some sort of confounding scenarios to that thesis. For example, South Korea, which is, well, has typically, historically been a very, certainly in the post-war period, was a very, 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 very Christian nation. Things are secularizing more then, but also there are other parts of Southeast Asia where you're seeing the total fertility rate really beginning to crater, where in a way that doesn't really seem to be correlated with religious observance at all.
That's interesting, because I went out to South Korea to write about, when I was writing my book, The End of Time, which is about apocalyptic belief. I went out to visit the Yoido Full Gospel Church, whatever it was called, Yonggi Cho's.
Oh, yeah, David Yonggi
Cho. Was the largest Christian church in the world.
Yeah.
What's happening to Christian demographics there? They were 40% of the population at the time.
Yes.
Christians. Is that still the case, do you know?
No. So I had a student who wrote a very interesting dissertation on this, and I think it was published, and she suggested that, in fact, there'd been a sort of wave of secularization, or said there had been some sort of evidence of secularization in South Korea in the 80s and 90s. But either way, I think it's still, even after those effects, it's still the case that it's has far higher levels of religiosity than anywhere in Europe, and yet has one of the worst total fertility rates on the planet, if not the worst. So the correlation is not, it really does puzzle sociologists and demographers. There doesn't seem to be any clear sense of why it's the case that only 3% of the planet enjoys replacement rate fertility. Clearly, it's got something to do with affluence. It's got something to do probably with status and the way in which... So if you look, for example, in Georgia and in Mongolia, motherhood is... So I think one of the top patriarchs in Georgia personally baptizes children who are the third or fourth children of in their families. Malaysia, I think, has a motherhood medal and a motherhood ceremony for mums who've had, you know, more than two or three kids. And so they're sort of attributing status to motherhood, which I think, you know, post-war feminism had really eroded because of the confusion, because of the sense that equality must mean sameness, and for women to be equal to men is for effectively women to be the same as men. Motherhood was always going to take a back seat in terms of status. And so that's probably got something to do with it. And it may be the case that traditional religious communities do elevate in as much as they see complementarity between men and women, between husbands and wives and mums and dads, as plainly compatible with the complementarity, as it were. Equality and complementarity go together. It could be that there's just greater status afforded to what it is to be a mother, which is, you know, to be a mother is to do is to undertake the most extraordinary thing that any human being can do, which is to bring new souls into the world.
I completely agree. And the fact is that we live in a society in the Western world in which one of the most countercultural things you can do is celebrate large families, which is not to say that, you know, I think it's the duty of women to have 10 children or, you know, I absolutely don't think that. But I do notice the absolute absence of celebration of the traditional family, which is a model that, for all its inevitable faults, because we're human beings, is the only one that works.
Mm, yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right, that the problem is not the decline of the nuclear family. The problem actually is much more upstream of that. It's the decline of the extended family. And intergenerational households, for example. I know in England, one of the distinctive things about England from the 11th, 12th century onwards is that family formation tended to be a lot more nuclear. There was much, much higher levels of geographic mobility around England. And so this is the work of Cambridge professor here, Alan McFarland, and his thesis about the emergence of English individualism. And so perhaps in England, we've never really had the great sort of that emphasis on the large extended family households that is the case, certainly was the case on the continent. But working out ways to recover that is going to be very, very important. And actually, ironically, it may be that technology makes that possible. I mean, I'm a bit of a skeptic of too much working from home for many, many professions. But I was talking actually to the MP for Devizes, Danny Kruger.
Oh, my former colleague at The Telegraph. Yes.
Who's written and thought a great deal about this. And one of the points that Danny was making is that high-speed internet in places like in Wiltshire, where he's an MP, has actually led to an extraordinary revival and recrudescence of small family businesses who are effectively able to, who are much less dependent on the metropolis for their entrepreneurship and the success of their enterprises. And now I don't know to what extent that's being replicated across the country, but I think one of the tasks facing conservatives and conservative communities is to think of not just to be tech skeptic the whole time. This is one of the things that JD and I have talked about quite a lot, in fact. In what ways can technology be, although yes, it does have these liquefying solvent effects on all that can, on much of what conservatives wish to conserve, it's also the case that there are ways in which technology can be harnessed to protect what we love, to protect what's closest to us and what most nurtures us as communities and faith communities and local communities and small businesses and so on. And that's one of the great challenges. And what way can one be a sort of right-wing progressive? That is to say, to look ahead with confidence to the future and not just, as many conservatives tend to do, yet just mired in nostalgia for the past, a nostalgie de la boue, as the French say.
Dr. James Orr, I'm so grateful to you for coming onto this podcast and look forward to talking again sometime. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Damien. Pleasure to be with you.